we've had samples over the years come in with like lysine digestibility values from 2.3 to 2.8%. And although it may not look a lot like a lot on paper, just looking at those small numbers, you get into the fact that you're constituting about 30% of the diet on an as weight basis. And those numbers start to add up really quickly. So currently there's the rooster bioassays as well as the chick bioassays that you can actually determine the nutritional profile for a sample for a feed ingredient.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with nonlinear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. The Poultry Science Association is dedicated to advancing poultry science worldwide. Learn more at poultryscience.org. Anatox, partnering with the world's food producers to develop and deliver innovative programs to efficiently produce safer food. Kemin invites you to optimize poultry health and nutrition. Dive in at kemin.com/poultry. Fortiva, creating ingredients for impact to support animal resilience and health. Learn more at fortivaimpact.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Poultry Nutrition Black Belt Podcast, where we discuss the latest in poultry nutrition research and industry trends in approximately 10 minutes. My name is Sam Rochel. I'm a co-host of the show and associate professor of poultry nutrition at Auburn University. Today, I'm joined by a PhD student, Thomas Jones from the University of Georgia, who's in the later stages of his PhD program there in Athens and has been doing some awesome work on correlating NIR data with some in vivo work that we're going to hear about, and ultimately developing new equations, I think, and it could be very interesting to our listeners who are dealing with ingredient variability. So, Thomas, look forward to hearing more about what you guys have been doing on this.
Thanks for having me. And I guess just to start, I can give an overview of kind of what we're doing and why we're doing it. So, So the main thing that we're focusing on right now is the variability in soybean meal. So it's notoriously what we use domestically, but also internationally for the amino acid source in poultry diets. So even though in the United States, we kind of have this refined process where we have the solvent extraction and heat extrusion, there's still a lot of variability, especially whenever you're looking at lysine. So we've had samples over the years come in with like lysine digestibility values from 2.3 to 2.8%. And although it may not look a lot like a lot on paper, just looking at those small numbers, you get into the fact that you're constituting about 30% of the diet on an as weight basis. And those numbers start to add up really quickly. So currently there's the rooster bioassays as well as the chick bioassays that you can actually determine the nutritional profile for a sample for a feed ingredient. But what's kind of lacking there is it takes about a month to complete one of these assays. So by the time that you've done that, that feed sample has already been fed, or if you're looking at quality assessment, maybe it's a little bit retrospective, like, hey, maybe we got the temperature too high here and, destroyed some of our lysine and had those indigestible complexes. But in terms of actually being able to assess product or ingredient quality at the feed mill, there's not really anything there. So kind of what we proposed was taking these rooster bioassay models and then taking a spectra from the feed ingredient and then seeing if we can correlate these values to be able to determine the nutrient value that's available to poultry at the feed mill level. So that's kind of the broad overview of what my dissertation topic is.
Just to give a little context, for everyone who may have very little familiarity with these assays. So the two live assays you mentioned, we talk about a chick assay, which requires growing the birds old enough to, or the age that we want to get the digestibility values, and then typically a terminal sampling from the ileum. Whereas in Dr. Davis's lab, I know kind of continuing the legacy of Dr. Nick Dale, who did these rooster assays, and I've had a lot of experience with this, at least seeing it with my previous advisor, Dr. Carl Parsons. But the beauty in this is you know, even though it is a bioassay and takes longer, you can maintain these roosters for a long period of time. You can run multiple samples through them. And, you know, really the sampling and the feeding and the sampling, you're talking about a few days versus a few weeks, which you still have the time for the drying and the analysis and all of that. But, you know, through this, I know over the really decades, but, you know, a lot of different soy samples have been evaluated there at University of Georgia. So that's given a big advantage and in insight into how to approach this. I just want to lay a little groundwork, historical groundwork for the audience that may not be as familiar with the how this is set up. So,
and that's kind of like the beauty that you mentioned of it is that whenever we're looking at these feed ingredients, we have a database that spans over years. So we get factors such as like agronomic conditions that may change from year to year. We're still evaluating those. But we also have these cultivar varieties that are constantly changing for like yield, but we may have some negative impacts in terms of digestibility for poultry. So we get to evaluate this a little bit over time. And even doing this, we saw some like trends in like total arginine levels and decreasing throughout the year. So the rooster bioassay is really just a high throughput assay that allows you to kind of decipher some of those things going on from an actual poultry level.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
That's awesome. It's very powerful. It's very awesome that you guys have a lot of different collaborators are sending in samples and relying on you to monitor this. So that's a really great insight you have. So, but as rapid as that is, it's still not as rapid as NIRS. So can you talk a little bit more about that and how you're integrating?
Yeah. So just to kind of put some numbers to some terms, we can do about 300 samples in a year with the rooster bioassays. And that's on a rotation of we've precision feed these birds every 2 days with some exceptions for holidays occasionally.
Right. Yeah.
But so we're limited to approximating about 300 samples a year. But with NIRS, it takes about 5 minutes to actually get a value once you have a calibration model set up. So we have used these historical values and applied them to a regression analysis, kind of. So we're correlating what the organic bonds are and kind of asking it, can you differentiate between what's an indigestible complex for poultry or what is digestible? And we're doing it in a direct method. So we're not using any digestibility coefficients. It's finding these spectral regions that are really high quality assays to actually approach it. But with that being said, since all the data is based upon these rooster assays, it's never going to be better than it, but it will offer an alternative with a comparable margin of error that you can expect kind of from the bioassays and the wet chemistry methods. So, and just in general, the methodology is kind of the same. It just looks a little bit different, but it increases that throughput so that whenever you're getting 30 rail cards of soybean a day, I can't ship all of those to have a rooster assay performed because A, that's expensive. And by the time that I get those results back, it's retrospective. So I can kind of determine maybe I don't want that manufacturer's product anymore, but what am I going to actually do for that poultry?
And I think you mentioned a key term there that I want to follow up on, margin of error, right? So you can get the value, but then we only have so much confidence in that value. We have a band on either side of it, or that spans either side of it, and we have to make a decision on where we want to be in that range. So you can talk a little bit about, your perspective and how you're able to maybe reduce that margin a little bit with the volume of samples that you have?
So we've looked at soy products throughout the years. And of course, you have your normal specs that you can apply to products. But with that, you're assuming that everything's pretty much in a standard range. And even with this feed ingredient that's commonly used, you still have some increased variability there.
Sure, yeah.
So what we kind of looked at is, what's the margin of error expected from the rooster assay and the wet chemistry analysis? And it looks a little bit different for different amino acids. Like, you get a higher margin of error with tryptophan than you do, say, arginine or lysine. But within this, we took kind of both the statistical approach and the applied approach. So you get this statistical output, then the most applicable one is really the root mean square error prediction, which is just a really fancy term for saying this is the average difference between what's predicted and what's determined by the assay. And for this, we get, for like methionine, for instance, it's less than 0.01%.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it's really spot on. But just to like kind of put that to an applied setting, so all of our samples, we had 216 in the initial calibration set. And we were able to predict all of them within 5% of their bioassay determined value.
Wow. Yeah.
And then just to like kind of further that a little bit more with the precision that we were actually able to acquire. So for all the amino acids, dispensable or indispensable, we were able to get over half of them within 2.5% of their bioassay determined value. So there's a lot of power there to be able to say this is reflecting what we actually see in the biochemistry, or the bioassay and the wet chemistry.
Very awesome. So this is incredible work. You know, you're learning a lot about, as you mentioned, how the ingredient changes all the way back to agronomic, and then how that could even translate, you know, over time. You can maybe even use this to monitor that through NIR as well, translating back to these bioassays. So I think this is something that's going to be very valuable to the industry. With that, I mean, do you see any limitations of this? I mean, there's still variation involved, even though it's reducing, but what other challenges do you see in applying this?
Yeah, so kind of where we've hit some limitations in the soybean side is that we can only be as good as the wet chemistry.
Yep.
So whenever we're working with these really small values for tryptophan, for instance, like a 0.6% on an as-is basis, you start having some 4 to 6% margins of error in between replicates there. And then it's, well, if we have that margin of error on top of what's already there, how close are we actually getting?
Right, right.
So that's kind of the limitation in terms of soybean. But another one is kind of forward thinking to, if we want something with increased variability, so let's talk animal byproducts. So there's not really that standard of a process. So whenever we're getting all these spectra files for the animal byproducts, they don't necessarily correspond with each other. And we kind of even toyed around with that a little bit with soy products, looking at some potential like soy protein concentrates or isolates, and just kind of seeing like they're made up of the same component essentially, but the processing is so different that you're leveraging it in one way or another. So kind of just determining if you can get some purified samples of those animal byproducts that aren't blended, maybe you can make something specific to porcine or something specific to bovine. But it looks, in terms of like limitations, it's not going to be able to implement everything all together.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is a little bit different for like the soy we had. So the soy calibration curves are both the mechanically expelled and the solvent extracted. And we were able to get them to kind of work with each other in a similar regard to kind of how they're used in the industry, since the real main difference is just the fat content there.
Awesome. Hey, I think this is going to be very impactful. I know after listening to this, a lot of people are going to be interested, and probably the number one question is, you know, are these equations accessible? And you may not be able to talk a lot about this right now, but just do you anticipate these being available at some point?
So I can talk about it a little bit. So we're in the final process of kind of So we did all of this in a laboratory environment. So it's very environmentally controlled. We have a standard operating procedure that all samples go through. But whenever you're actually thinking about where these methods would be applied, it would be primarily either in the feed manufacturing or in the feed mill setting. So right now we're kind of working on elucidating if there's differences between like spectrometers or if particle size can kind of influence the predictions. Because unlike the proximate quantitative methods that are available that have like these really broad ranges, we have very specific ranges here for digestible amino acids and nitrogen corrected true metabolizable energy. So it's looking at, are they so specified that this is going to impede our transferability to other spectrometers? We have some preliminary data that says, yes, we've seen statistical significant differences between spectrometer type and particle size, but the key part is that it's all been directional. So what we can do with the directionality is just incorporate a bias to account for the different particle size or the different spectrometer, and then your prediction will be within the same margin of error as expected if we were conducting it here at UGA. So that's kind of the next phase, to kind of see if there's any more factors, environmental factors, that may impact the margin of error before it's actually commercially available. But it is expected to be sometime here soon.
Okay.
We won't put a date on it. But yeah, sometimes here soon.
Well, thanks for sharing this work, Thomas. Again, I think this is very valuable and impactful, and wish you the best of luck in finishing your program and, you know, hopefully seeing this technology through for the end users. So
thank you for having me, and glad I could share a little bit about it.
You bet. Thanks again. Thanks to all the listeners for joining us on another episode of this Poultry Nutrition Black Belt podcast. If you enjoyed it, please like and subscribe, and we'll catch you on the next one. Thank you.